Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started with the tanker panel. Got to try to keep Nicholas on schedule here. So as everyone files in, I'm Chris Weatherby. I'm the transportation and shipping analyst at Citi, and I'm very pleased to be joined with an esteemed panel here to talk about the tanker panel. And I think there was a little discussion before we started and before I introduce everyone that we needed to make this panel at least as interesting as the dry bulk panel this morning. So we're going to put a little bit of pressure on our panelists here, but I'm sure they're going to deliver for us. So to my left, let me just go through some quick introductions. To my left is Patty Rogers, who's the CEO of Euronav. To his left is Lois Abraki, who's International Seaway CEO. I have Mr. Nick Tsakos to her left, which is he's the CEO of Tsakos, as well as the chairman of Intertanko, and then Mr. Ted Patrone, who's the vice chairman of Navios Corporation, representing a whole host of Navios companies here, and then Mr. Bob Burke, who's the partner and CEO of Richberry Tankers, to Ted's left. So we have a great lineup of folks that we're going to talk about tankers with, and we should just go ahead and jump right in. So, you know, I think one of the things that I always like to sort of start this, you know, these types of panels with is a quick sort of discussion of the broader market and kind of how things are trending. And, you know, I'm going to go to Patty, who has historically been great in terms of delivering very interesting remarks on the market and how people should perceive the market. So what I would like to start with, Patty, if you could help us sort of walk through the state of demand in the market for crude tankers today, and maybe talk about any misperceptions you might feel are out there about tankers today.
Well, thank you, Christian, and thanks for the very kind introduction. I think our in-house view from looking at it is that demand remains surprisingly resilient and strong. So there's no issue really around the demand side for consumption of crude. I think we always thought that the cutback by OPEC and the non-OPEC group would actually stimulate ton miles, and that's been proven. We've been shipping quite a lot of oil out of the US Gulf to China, so there's been a big ton mile lift. So for shipping, anyway, the issue really is just the additional supply of tonnage. But I don't think it's been anywhere near as disastrous as might have been predicted or expected. Rates are weaker, but the volumes stay high. So all in all, this looks like a year, again, that could be a bit range-bound. I don't expect to see any huge spikes, and we could have a little bit of downturn during the summer, and maybe that'll carry on into the winter. But on the earnings side, I don't think it's going to be a shocking year, and I think most people have got their predictions right. I think that the question for all of us, really, is there's only really one question on whether it's in tanker shipping or dry bulk or containers. There is only one question, and the question is, what's going to happen in Korea to the shipyard capacity? Because if that empty berth capacity is turned on any sector, that sector can be overbuilt very quickly. So everybody's quite anxious about that. We believe that tankers is reasonably well set up because it's become increasingly less speculative and much more an operator's culture. So staying range-bound on operations, on operational earnings, may well actually be in our interest.
Okay, that's very helpful. I appreciate that. Lois, I wanted to see if you had any thoughts on the price of crude itself. So there's been a lot of volatility, and I cover a host of companies across transportation as well as shipping, and so there's a lot of discussion about the rebound in energy markets and where we stand today. And we've had this recent dip back. Do you see any sweet spot in terms of the crude oil price that makes the most sense or provides the best backdrop for the tanker market?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, clearly, as a, you know, tanker owner, we want ton miles and we want trade. You know, it's better for us to have, oil prices in a place where they stimulate demand. So somewhere around where we are is kind of interesting, and I think it will be range-bound, and you're not going to have, you know, you see a lot of the analysts pulling in their oil prices now. So, you know, what's quite interesting is the U.S. coming up to 9 million barrels a day, very quickly ramping back up, and as soon as prices went into the mid-50s and close to 60, they hedged their production, and then the oil patch comes back on strong. You know, as Patty said, then we start to see crude leaving the U.S. You know, we're doing reverse lighterings. You know, Afras are bringing it out to V's, and you're seeing some moves, it's not huge, to China from the Gulf. So for us, I would think you know, somewhere in the 50s is, you know, a really good place for oil to be.
Do you think, just sort of following up and sort of the thrust of that question is, do you think that some of the efforts of the Saudis or other folks who may be inclined to initially cut back and then sort of potentially turn spigots on have sort of a broader positive potential benefit to the tanker market? So to the extent that you sort of reach a ceiling in the mid-50s, bounce down to the mid-40s, is that a scenario where we kind of keep the most amount of crude in the market, potentially benefiting length of haul and ultimately volumes and cargoes?
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, not to be selfish, but, you know, we're a tanker company. So for us, you know, we want to see oil be moved. So when you see, you know, oil is, you know, demand growth of 1.5, 1.4, 1.3 million barrels a day per year, that's constructive for us. You know, you see oil retain its competitive spot in the overall energy picture, and that's what we want.
Okay, that's really helpful. Nick, if I could ask you to talk a little bit, give us some thoughts on China and sort of how you think about that playing out from both the refinery perspective, I guess just broad demand from China, where we see that going over the course of the next 12 months or so, that'd be helpful.
Yes, thank you. And again, I want to congratulate also you and Nick Bornozis for his timing. I think he's developing, Nick Bornozis is developing a presentation time market indicator.
It sure is, yeah.
So when you see the dry cargo market being before the tankers, you know it's going to be a good year for, you don't have to even come to the presentation, just look. So we get the slots after lunch, so you know we have to play an extra effort in what we're doing. Well, China has always been, if you remember a year ago, it was, I would say last January and February, we were sitting here and we were terrorized by the prospects of a collapse in demand coming from China. We never thought that we would see a Brexit, and there was quite a question mark about the U.S. politics. So a year later, I think China kept its growth perspectives, and I think as Patty said, we're not expecting any great surprises. There is demand for our business. What is worrying us in the back of our mind could be any protectionism, which is very bad for shipping, because although ship owners sounds like a very prestigious business, we're really like, you know, the truck drivers of the seas. If you cannot find anything to move, It's not positive for the business. So I think China is working, and albeit for any other protectionist moves, and if we can tap a little bit the supply of tonnage, we will be looking at another positive year, and hopefully the prospects for 18, later in 17 and 18, will be even better as far as the tankers.
Ted, you look like you want to jump in. I do want to ask you sort of the next question, but I want to stick on the demand side, just thinking about other areas maybe outside of China where you could see some level of incremental demand, or where maybe we could be surprised either to the up or downside on that incremental barrels per day that we talk about.
Okay, so starting with China. No. Listen, India has hit a per capita GDP of about 4,000. That has been historically a very good jumping point for increasing car sales. And so we also see India, I mean, as being, you know, years ago on the dry side, the dry sort of hoped India would be the next step up, right, the next great economy moving forward. It missed that on the dry, but I do think certainly, you know, on the wet side, I do think there's a higher probability that it steps up. And not only that, but all Southeast Asia, right, they're urbanizing, transportation, they're buying cars. You see what we've done. Us car sales are dramatic, but our gasoline consumption is down in the States because we're replacing cars. In Southeast Asia, they're not. So I think that whole area of the world is actually quite good. And then just going back to China, you know, I think their CAGR rate for oil has been on growth has been 14% since 2009. They're producing less oil. You know, they're now below 4 million barrels a day. And they'll need for oil from further away, right? As the Middle East cracks the barrel and they put out more products, it's going to come from the Atlantic Basin. So I think China, you know, every year we hear that the supply is going to fall, but it looks like they've moderated growth, and that's healthy in the long run.
Okay, makes sense. And Bob, just wanted to kind of round out, when you think about the demand side, you know, one of the things, and obviously pulls into supply here too, but is the ton-mile story within tankers. And I guess I just wanted to get a sense sort of what your thoughts are, or maybe what inning we are in terms of that ton-mile story? We had a nice sort of pull in 2015 and want to get a sense maybe what we can think about for 2017 in terms of adding sort of, you know, or sucking up incremental capacity.
Yeah, we're at the bottom of the fourth.
Okay.
But before I answer...
That's very specific. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, Nick said that we're the truck drivers of the sea, and it's interesting he said that. When people who are not in shipping ask me what I do for a living, I say we own tankers. The way I explain it is, you know, we're Uber for oil, and it sort of summarizes what we are. So we are very sensitive to ton miles and where the oil is coming from and going to. And like I think Patty said, when OPEC pulled back, we were a bit encouraged because we thought that more oil would be coming out of the Atlantic Basin, which is further from where the new demand or the continued increase in demand is, which is, as we all talked about, China and Southeast Asia. So, you know, we're hopeful the next year or so that will continue. I mean, ton miles are increasing, and as I think Patty said earlier, it's all about supply. We're more nervous about the supply side. The demand doesn't seem to have any issues. We see more oil come out of the U.S. Gulf. You know, our sponsor is Riverstone, who's almost exclusively in the energy business, and so we get very close to the energy sector. The increases in technology and the increase in technology and the kind of the condensing of the price stack and the expenses in the U.S. is phenomenal. I've seen technology increases of 200 or 300%. So I think the 9 million mark will be passed, and then 9.5, and it'll go from there. So we're very positive on the supply side. It's the demand that makes us the most worried.
Okay.
Especially, you know, we all hear 30% capacity reduction in Korea, but as someone mentioned, if that's all focused in one sector, then we have a big problem.
Gotcha. And so thinking about sort of the order book side, sticking with you, Bob, what do you think about in terms of the actual growth in the fleet this year, next year? So I think the order book is, you know, just over mid or in the high mid single digits or so in terms of the size of the fleet. How should we expect, you know, what should we expect to actually deliver this year and next year? And, you know, how does that sort of development persist?
Well, most of it actually gets delivered because we follow the, you know, the ships that are delayed, and it seems to roll over from one year to the next. And the 20% that was delayed last year rolls into this year. So, I mean, the order book is certainly problematic. You know, I think the hope on our side is the scrap continues to go up, and now it's at 380 or 385, and some of the old ships get cleared out. But it's, you know, it's definitely problematic, especially as we get towards the end of this year.
Patty, what do you, just on that scrapping price, I was looking at a chart earlier today, and it certainly has been rising. What do you think is sort of, I don't want to say a magic level, but what do you think is a level we can start clearing more of this market?
Well, actually, I'm less concerned about the absolute level than the volatility, because I think that the what's been holding back a lot of scrapping has been quite a steady price. And I think that people can kind of bank that price, and therefore they don't think that the decision's very urgent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if the oil price, if the steel price climbs to $500 or $600 a ton and then crashes back down again, you've got a lot of people sit up and start thinking very hard about the relative value of pushing a dry dock, another couple of voyages, or scrapping. So I think actually, like most of these things, it's the dynamic that's more important than the absolute number. Yep. Because this goes back a little bit to the order book delivery. I don't think it's so important, the absolute number, as the pace of change.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're accelerating where more ships are coming every month, that has an impact which affects the outlook on the market. If you turn the corner and that starts to decrease, regardless of the fact the market might be a little bit oversupplied, the impact is different. The quickest thing we can change in shipping is the speed of a ship. And as long as people get convinced that it's time to slow down to improve overall earnings, then eventually you can impose that, and it will work. And I say impose it comes just naturally economically. Everybody knows how it works. I think that's what we'll see coming in now, that people will start to slow their ships down. I think we can absorb the new buildings that are coming, but it will be at a low rate. But the moment that starts to slow down the delivery of the ships, the market can pick up again quite quickly.
And Patty, I think if you look at how many VLs the Suez has been scrapped the past 4 years, I mean, it's single digits. And if that price does spike up quickly, we'll see a lot cleared out, I hope.
And
especially,
I think,
with the you know, the sulfur requirements coming along
exactly.
Very quickly.
I think having the dirty water ballast convention starting in September, middle of September this year, and the SOx and the sulfur, I think that will make people think twice to pass a third special survey.
Sure.
in case the price of scrap is also, as you said, closer to 400 or 450. I think that will be a good alternative. So I think we could see a little bit more of scrapping happening because of technological changes also on the ships.
And do you think that really reinforces sort of, we see a lot of company presentations, a delineation of the fleet between younger than 15 years old and older than 15 years old. And a guy like me who's an analyst sitting on my seat where I'm not actually operating or owning these vessels, I sometimes see that as a bit arbitrary. But when you think about some of these regulatory dynamics coming out, do you think that further reinforces it? And from a chartering perspective, from an actual hiring perspective, will we start to see, you know, even more of a differentiation amongst the older and sort of younger tonnage?
It's dynamic, isn't it? I mean, and you're quite right, it is arbitrary. And I'm sure that everybody knows that there are ships that look like they just left the shipyard and they're 18 years old. And getting them fixed is going to be easier than getting ships that look, that look like a robber's dog. So I think there's a balance there between what the ships look like and how they've been maintained. But the reality is this, that if the market's weak and shipping's cheap and you get to choose, you take a younger ship. Chartering executives also manage risk. So the pressure comes on as the market softens. No one is going to take an 18-year-old ship to the scrapyard in a market that is more than washing its face. If you're making money, you'll keep it going. But I think that the crunch time comes, volatility in the scrap price, expensive dry docking, potential additional capital expenditure, and uncertainty about future earnings, and then all of a sudden you might get the magic where somebody just says, the risk isn't worth the potential reward. I'll take the scrap now while I can still get it.
Sure.
And then you'll see that drive towards getting the ships off the fleet.
Okay. Lois, in terms of getting to sort of over the hump, I guess, when I think about the order book and maybe to Patty's point, we're sort of the second derivative, the rate of change of delivery, and we start to see that working in our favor. How should we be visualizing that? I mean, we've seen movements in other end markets within shipping, and we talked about the dry bulk panel earlier. But when you think about where we are in the cycle, you could potentially make an argument that maybe we're, you know, getting to the point where that second derivative is going to change more in our favor, and we could be getting over that hump. How do you think about that?
Chris, you're not allowed to ask us about second derivative changes on a panel. That's just way too confusing.
Well, Patty took us there. I'm not smart enough to go there on my own, but.
One of the things that I would say differentiates, you know, where we are right now in the tankers versus where, you know, it was, I think, more brutal in the dry, you know, on the tanker side. You know, we're talking about asset values that have fallen by 30% year on year, but, you know, we're only now coming off a quarter where for VLCCs in Q1, you know, owners average somewhere around 40 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, it's hard to say that you're in capitulation in that market, right? So there could be more pain to come as we absorb the tankers that are coming down the pike. So, you know, I don't think that you're going to see vessels leave the space until you have a cash crunch, as Patty was saying, you know, where if you can't, you know, meet your cash break-evens and, you know, we're not there on the tanker space. So I do think you'll see vessels leave the space, but it won't be en masse, you know, where you're going to have a great amount of older vessels leave just immediately.
Sure. Yeah. Ted, what are your thoughts in terms of maybe a similar question? Just get a sense of maybe how Navios is thinking about managing through the cycle and where you think we are in that cycle.
You know, I think to start off, just, you know, just going back to Patty's point, I think the iron or the steel price will stay firm simply because I'm crossing over sections here, but the steel mills in China are making money. It means there's real demand for steel. It means the price, I think the price will go up, but I do think with asset prices going down, think of it, pretty soon, you may be able to scrap an 18-year-old V and get close to $20 million and buy a 10-year-old for 40 or so. I mean, that differential collapses and allows people to scrap and renew their fleet. And that's a good thing going forward. I think there was a lot of Vs that were delivered in January. They all got held over. So I think that has to be sort of chewed up by the market. But I do take Robert's point about there's a lot more oil coming from the Atlantic. We're all worried about OPEC, but if OPEC is at 80% compliance and they're doing 1,900,000 less, I mean the U.S. is producing centuries. The Kazakhstan's coming on. There's a lot of oil coming from the Atlantic, and it really is a ton mile game. And I think that will continue to give rates. I think the rates are going to surprise people. Look what we did last year. We were 7% net fleet growth, and we averaged 41,000 a day. Mm-hmm. And so if you would have told me that on January 1st last year, I wouldn't have put in 41,000, I'll tell you that.
So, Pat, you've talked about this sort of maybe becoming a little less cyclical or maybe a longer-term sustainability of rates that are sort of money-making, right, and getting a little bit more maturity to this market and making it less sort of boom and bust. Do you think that we are setting up the building blocks for a market like that over the course of the next several years where you may not dip into those very, very low rates, but you may also sort of cap yourself from the very, very high rates too?
Well, I mean, this is the subject that's been discussed for 20 years at least in shipping, more in hope than in expectation. And there's this idea that if you gave up the upside, somebody would give you back the downside. Well, first of all, there's no deal like that that's going to be formally struck. I think that we've always said there were three things about tanker shipping was seasonality because of the way that the big consumers are in the Northern Hemisphere. We talked about volatility because of the way that the market operates as an auction market, which creates extreme marginal pricing. The third thing is cyclicality, and I don't believe cyclicality is created by economic factors. It's created by funds flow into shipping. And normally that can be seen where you see the economy growing to the point, and a very good example would be where the stock market is today, at 18 times earnings. You know, when people are taking that kind of risk on ordinary investment, then they're going to look around and think about shipping. And in the past, when that's been going on, it hasn't just gone on for economic reasons. It's also often gone on for what we might call distorted reasons. Like, let's be quite frank, the whole German Landesbank system was a complete financial distortion. And that availability of capital into shipping created a lot of the cyclicality. The capital flows in, the prices go up, new ships get ordered, the capital flows out as there's an oversupply, and you just get this boom and bust. Now, if we move into markets that become increasingly regulated, then I do believe there is a chance that we begin to see that that capital inflow stops. And the critical capital inflows we're probably looking at today are state government funding of Korean shipyards. If the shipyards had to live up to a proper balance sheet, there would be considerably less productive capacity. And that's the big overhang for us. So can they keep the Koreans out? Secondly, is there going to be a grey market in financing that pops out of China or elsewhere? If Basel 3 and 4 force conventional lending out of the market, that's fine as long as it doesn't just result in a grey market, which we saw to some extent with private equity involvement. Mm-hmm. So these are all the factors that are going to worry us. If those all got regulated, if there was a level playing field where everything got regulated in terms of the way that people had to analyse their risk, then perhaps we would squeeze capital out of the shipping industry to a point where the fleet size is moderated at a size of that was actually required and where earnings justified it prices and investments. And that's the hoped-for goal. I think actually where we are today looks like we're getting a lot of it, but the proof will be in the next 2 years.
Christian, if I can say on this point, and it is also obvious that the cost of transportation is really still a very marginal, a very low figure for the end user at the end of, and for the consumer. So even if our rates doubled from what they are, I mean, today we represent in a good market 1 or 1.5% on the price of the barrel. Even if that became 3, the consumer would not feel that. So there is quite a lot of space to have a more sustainable future going forward, like rather than this boom and bust scenario that we're going. And I believe that slowly we're in tankers at least. Don't forget, in tankers it's a business for very simple people like us. We carry 1 or 2 commodities. It's not like very sophisticated people in dry that they have to deal with all these commodities. We either do products or crude and perhaps sometimes some gas here and there. So if we can keep it simple, stupid, as they say, I think we can see our rates at least being more sustainable.
I think the biggest driver in the cyclicality, well, it's 2 things, the rates and the leverage. And I think for many, many, many years, it's been a misallocation of risk between debt and equity in our industry. And I think some of the banks have left. Well, a lot of banks left, and then private equity stepped in, which overstepped. And they seem to have come back a bit, or at least been educated. But I think, at least in my lifetime, the past 30 years or so in this business, it's been banks that have taken more risk than they've been paid for. And that's changed substantially. And I think you see it. Especially ships over 10 years old, they're priced almost all equity. The price of those vessels have dropped. So the owners of those vessels are forced to make a decision based upon their own balance sheet and their own returns, as opposed to pushing that off to an institution. So if that continues, I think the volatility won't be eliminated, but it'll be reduced.
And I think if we are going into a higher interest rate environment, it'll stop some of the PE guys. When they were sitting on money, you didn't know what to do with it. It wasn't earning anything. I think that could change going forward.
So are we seeing any equity coming back into the market from some of these outside forces? Bob, I think you mentioned maybe a little bit, but I'm just trying to get a sense of are we seeing anything that would resemble at all what we've seen from private equity in previous cycles?
I think that people in this room have been very successful at educating some of the new money that came in, who now focus on the operator, the background of the people operating the ships. They realize that it's not a trade and that we're not a space. You know, we're an industry. They differentiate between the shipyards. They understand they just can't order a bunch of ships and have optionality that's for free. And that the other thing I think they've figured out is that the decision process on what ships to buy and when to buy them has to be a lot closer to the ground than guys in New York who maybe don't know the ins and outs of the industry as well as maybe some of the people in the room do. So I think the private equity groups that have stayed in are much more well-informed and are teamed up with folks who are, more experienced. So it is, I think, still there to some degree, but not in the massive, let's go out and order 10 option 10 that it was a few years ago. And that's the key to us, I think. Folks want to buy secondhand tonnage. They don't want to go out and order a bunch of specs.
Okay. So more equity, maybe smarter money. You have the potential for maybe some of the building blocks of that less cyclical industry. I guess, Patty, to your point, the next several years will tell how that plays out.
If the investments in
and
steel
support.
On the water, sorry, Pat. If the investments are steel on the water, you're stopping the invest. You know, you're not. That's good. That's okay.
Sure. This is zero effect. Right. It's a zero sum
sure.
game.
Exactly.
Okay. Makes sense. Makes sense. So one of the things that's been discussed at several panels, and I like to think about this, although I have rarely seen any of it actually occur, is consolidation in the industry. So. This is kind of a question that guys like me always like to ask guys like you and gals like you. So just kind of curious, how should we be thinking about consolidation? Will we ever see meaningful consolidation amongst large fleets? I mean, we've seen some, I guess, but, you know, anything material, any public company?
It fits in a little bit with that financing angle in the last question, because probably the biggest consolidator at the moment is KDB. They just haven't acknowledged it yet. I think that Korean Development Bank has control or ownership of 100 companies associated with the shipping industry, including obviously from the obvious ones like huge shipyards like DSME, mm-hmm. all the way down to all the service providers and some of the shipping companies in Korea. So I think we've had that kind of grey consolidation. I think there's a lot of consolidation in the German banking industry that needs to be sorted out. But I think the kind of consolidation that you mean, active business model where people go out and demonstrate that management and a company can add value to steel, I don't know. We're having, it'd be very interesting to know what people's perspectives are, because we're having the quietest hostile takeover ever. I guess Svein dropped off the list because he didn't want to have to answer too many questions about it, because he'd be a natural. I'd love to know what everybody thinks about it, because is there any other sector in the world where, you know, two of the headline companies could be one after the other and nobody really comments on it? I mean, there are some analysts in the audience, but they don't seem to want to stick their hands up and have an opinion on you should do this, or none of you want to stick your hands up and say that team's not doing the right job, they should be accepting this order. I mean, if I was involved in it, I'd be annoyed that we got so little attention.
This is your lawyer coming out on you again.
He's
trying to get a fee anyway.
There should be more shouting.
But I think in consolidation, we are a very fragmented industry. Mm-hmm. But we are believers of the commercial consolidation. I mean, I believe there are companies out there that they might have a small fleet of 20, 30 ships, but they could still run a tight ship. But I think what we need is not the operational consolidation. It's so marginal what you can offer. It might be $200, $300 a day. But I think the commercial consolidation through poolings, which is a way to do it, is something very important. And I think most of us here participate in pools. And I think when you have to deal with no more than two dozen clients, and you need to be consolidated, not to be used as the weakest link in rate setting.
But Nick, I'm sure you'll agree with me that the consolidator must have the same skin in the game as the owner. What you can't have, and this is, of course, one of my great hobby horses, is that you must not have simply a captive brokerage. So, you know, putting your ships with an operator who you call a pool, who charges a, you know, fixed amount of money which makes their business model work, whilst you simply take whatever the market serves up, is not the consolidation we're talking about. We're talking about the consolidation where you can more effectively price the service and where people have a vested interest in pricing that well.
Wilson. Ted or Bob or Lois, any thoughts on consolidation?
I've been in this industry longer than I want to admit, and I've heard consolidation going on for a long time. Look at the container industry, probably the most consolidated of the three, not doing very well. But I do think the commercial, the pooling is the way to go. I just don't see, you know, there's 11,000 ships in dry and there's 6,500 ships in tankers of different sizes, and it's very fragmented. Unless the world changes, I really don't see. You know, you need to get to where it's almost an oligopoly, where 10 owners control 30% of the business, so like the iron ore guys. If you don't get to that critical mass, you can pool all you want. As Patty said, you can do a lot of things. And pooling works, right? You can get above the index. You can do well. But in terms of consolidating industry, I don't really see that happening.
You have low barriers to entry. You don't get economies of scale above 20 or 30 ships of any significance. You have no technological advantage. We're commodity priced for moving assets around the world. So it doesn't lend itself, from a classical sense, to any rational consolidation on a massive scale. And if someone is able to maintain a market position where they get a price advantage, you'll get eroded away by people buying more ships. And I think also, if I'm a ship owner and I'm looking to grow my business, I can go elephant hunting and try to merge with someone else at the table, or they can try to merge with me, which is a lot of energy and time. Or you can buy single ships or order ships. And if you look at the S&P sheets every week and add up the ships that are purchased on a single or en bloc basis for two or three vessels, it far surpasses the amount of M&A activity you see on the stock market or in the private equity deals. So I think, like everyone else said, I mean, the commercial consolidation is easier. There are a lot of benefits to it. And whether, you know, the owners are involved or not, I think is almost irrelevant, and Patty and I can argue about that later on. But you know,
and obviously, I think that if you're in favour of consolidation, then what I would recommend is writing to the board of DHT, proposing.
You're really going out.
Proposing that they accept the deal, then John will own DHT. John is in VLCC Chartering, which is a partner of TI Pool, in which Euronav is a major player. And Euronav, of course, is not only a significant owner-operator, but we're also one of the founding partners of the TI Pool. If you want to get up-to-date information on the tanker market, you can, of course, download the TI app, which is available from your app store.
Thank you.
Well,
for
I can run this a little bit longer if you want.
That was a great commercial. I appreciate it.
In as well.
That's not all. Lois, you have to have an opportunity to chime in.
Wait, there's great more comments
from everybody else. And if you order before midnight tonight.
After all of the color there, you know, maybe the one element that didn't go mentioned was the personalities, you know, in shipping, you know, when you try to do consolidation, it can get very interesting very quickly, you know, with all of the different viewpoints.
Didn't realize there were actually strong personalities in shipping, but thanks for pointing that out. That was very
But
was very
I think
helpful.
The personalities, they should be irrelevant. I mean, it's a matter of money. And if the personalities have a say in what happens to the shareholders, there's a misalignment of interest between the management and the shareholders and the board. That's what drives that. And we see it over and over again, which is a whole other discussion. It should not be an issue. There are strong personalities in every industry. And actually, I don't think there should be a bunch of companies in the same industry that are priced very differently as far as NAV goes, where they're able to stay independent. I mean, if there was proper governance across the board, the ones with lower NAV numbers or EBITDA numbers would be consolidated very quickly by the ones who have a stronger one, and it just doesn't happen.
You know, one other thing that, you know, we didn't mention, because everybody talked about commercial and, you know, those aspects, but, you know, tanker shipping has a lot to do with operations and, you know, what is your nationality of crew, where you've trained them, you know, there's, you know, the largest component in your operational expenses is your crew costs. And, you know, that's the blocking and tackling of running a tanker company. It's an important component when you're trying to do a combination of any sort.
And that's why I think, Luis, you hit the nail on the head. It's the industry is so demanding operationally. And right now, the biggest problem we have as an industry, and we look at it as Intertanko, is that we might be building state-of-the-art ships, but we are lacking the software, the personnel. Mm-hmm. And by keeping a diversified portfolio of managers through commercial, I would say, consolidation, you have better chances to be able to have these pools of seafarers around the world and different operational methods. So I think that's why we in Intertanko, you know, we are promoting as much as possible the commercial consolidation and keeping, as you said, there are personalities, people want to run their ships in a different method operationally, and we should let them at it as long as it's safe and it makes economic sense.
That's great. Also, the consolidation question did get some interesting responses, so I appreciate that. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about stocks and how to think about, you know, when you want to invest in tanker stocks. So we can look at the last 18 months or so, and it hasn't necessarily been a great investment scenario to be long tanker stocks. But when do you think about buying these? If you're advising, putting yourself into my shoes and advising investors to be taking a look at this group or putting capital to work in this group when they can look other places, when do you buy this?
Well, yeah, I think that people often describe it as you need to have faith or you have to have a view on the market. I don't think that's true. I think the trouble is that people, we tend to talk about shipping in isolation. Right now, I think anybody who's invested in equities should be quite anxious. You know, if you've got 18 times earnings, equities are overpriced. There's been a huge reflationary buy on the equity side because of the tweets of Mr. Trump. And unfortunately, the market might get trumped because the problem is this. You've got equities up. You've got interest rates going up on the basis that people think this government's going to have to borrow a lot of money in order to stuff $54 billion into the arms industry, that it's got to build a wall, which I managed to get over this morning to get into the country. It wasn't easy, but then. Salaam alaikum. I made
back,
it.
Back to ships, back to ships.
All of these, you know, politics is back in, and a lot of mainstream business is actually buying into a political story which is yet undeveloped. So there's a lot of risk coming in on earnings forecasts now. Why? Because a lot of the reflationary stuff that was promised and has been tweeted about isn't getting done. And why isn't it getting done? Because whilst people are busy pulling each other's hair out in Washington, nobody's actually staffing government. This is the most understaffed government there's ever been. Just taking the tariff that was being proposed on imported oil.
Paddy, are we going to talk about ships or politics today?
No, it's very important to us. Okay, this is right. Very important to us. Because we talk about the tariffs coming in and the oil patch. Everybody has a lot of different views on it. Nobody knows who to phone up in government to get an answer about what the legislation is going to look like. Two big items coming up within the next 4 years. One is being started by the US, and that's China. Trade war with China would be very, very bad for everybody. And secondly, North Korea is going to come up. That's a massive risk factor. North Korea's got to be dealt with in the next 4 years. Don't forget where North Korea is, very close to all the shipyards of China and Korea. So there's a wild swan element to shipping. Shipping is not as bad as it looks. It's maybe an investment that you should be careful not to miss out on. And trying to call the bottom would make a big mistake. If we're back into an area where we've had our prices fall by 30% in the last year, we've had our share prices penalized despite the good earnings we've talked about, now we see prices beginning to flatten out, we see earnings moderating, you've basically got a position where there is no cost in carrying the stock. With the potential tweaks upside, and with all the things that can happen that will benefit shipping or could benefit shipping, it's something that you shouldn't overlook. And you shouldn't go to sleep safely on the values and the earnings that you're forecasting for your other stocks, which seem to be so invulnerable to the things that we suffer from.
Bob, your thoughts on shipping equities?
I agree with the valuation proposition. I mean, shipping moves quickly. The values move quickly. The charter rates move quickly. And as we all know, it's something we're not contemplating that's going to drive this market 6 months or a year from now. If you look back at all the inflection points, they're all things that none of us thought about. It wasn't that oil is going to move $10. It wasn't that, you know, a few million barrels come from here or there. It's some outside force that none of us could think about in advance. And the only time to buy ships is when they're cheap. And that is the fundamental decision you have to make. I think it's a fundamental flaw of the public companies because they can't raise money when ships are cheap because their stocks are cheap. And eventually, if they carry on that way, it's a fatal flaw in the structure. You know, as a private company, we're able to buy ships when they're cheap and sell them when we want. And we're not forced to grow. We can just sit. And I think the pressure on public companies to grow is really fierce, and it doesn't really lend itself to high stock prices in our business.
And Patty's right. I think the downside risk on the Dow is the probability of the downside risk is a lot greater than the downside risk in any of the shares that you're looking at up here that we're representing. And if the job growth is moving ahead, no matter how... Listen, Patty, I think as an American, a understaffed Washington, D.C. is a good thing. I know, they could all go on vacation.
Deliberately understaffed might be a good thing, not accidentally.
Well, in either case, it's good for us. But if they go away and the jobs and the industry takes and the economy takes care of itself and you have job growth, you'll have inflationary pressure. If there's inflationary pressure, invest in steel.
Well, now that we have solved the problems with the cabinet,
yes.
And I think we're very close in solving the North Korean issue, and thank you, Buddy, for your input in this. I hope you didn't mean that we're going to use North Korea to reduce the shipbuilding capacity in China. Because I think that will be used today.
Nick, you may well think that. I could not possibly comment.
But, we all said it. The time to buy shipping stocks is really when, or tanker stocks, it's when nobody really wants to hear anything about tankers. And I think we're very close to that position, which is now, I think we are the most, you see, Nick kindly put us after lunch, so most people are asleep in our presentation, so it was, this is the time to buy.
That's right. If we were at 11 o'clock in the morning, I think maybe it would be time to sell, I guess. So I guess that's probably helpful. We only have a few minutes left, so I want to make sure the audience gets an opportunity to chime in. This has been a fantastic panel so far, so if there are any questions, more than happy to go. Otherwise, I can ask another sort of valuation question that might get certain people on the panel a little bit interested, but... Sure, right down here in the front. I think there's a mic coming your way.
Harris Andonio. Thank you. Great panel indeed. One question related to regulation. We talked briefly this morning about water ballast regulation as well as sulfur regulation. I mean, obviously that's going to have a capital expenditure impact on companies and ships and maybe on the fleet as a whole. Can you comment how your company is going to deal with this going forward?
Well, I think on we're in the middle of renewing a significant part of the fleet, all of it on very long time charters. So we're not building ships without predetermined employment. All the ships that we have built have the capacity; they are LNG ready, as they say. I mean, to use gas as a fuel technology. And they have the capacity, if, God forbid, scrubbers are imposed, to have the space for scrubbers. But, of course, even on new ships, that will be a significant expense. As Intertango, we believe that the ships should not become refineries. Refineries are all around the world, and we don't believe it's a safe issue to have a scrubber on board our ships. So we believe that hopefully by 2020, distillates and other ways of fueling our vessels will be around, so we don't have to go through this exercise.
I think it helps scrapping, first of all. I think it helps our rates. But I do worry that the U.S. and the European older refineries have the ability to produce this product by the deadline, the self-imposed deadline. They're already talking about waivers. I mean, some of these technical guys know more than I do. But listen, double hulls were put in, what, 93 and took 20 years to get them out. I think there's going to be a lot of waivers. I think it's going to go on for a little bit longer than people think. And you're going to have to get common sense in the deadline on this going forward.
But, Ted, you're talking about sulfur.
Yeah,
what
were we talking about? Sorry, am I talking about something?
No, both. He was asking about ballast water and sulfur, but absolutely. You're talking about the sulfur and the scrubbers. Yeah.
Right, and also on the ballast water, I think one system has been approved by the Coast Guard so far. I mean,
one or two. Just a couple.
So
I mean,
who's going to invest now going forward? Our idea has always been wait a year and it's twice as good at half the price.
Yeah, it's not. It doesn't pay to be a first mover in you know these technologies because the technology is converging with the regulations and you know which companies will be the you know the winners in the space are only being defined now. But most owners, and I'm sure Navios is, you know, certainly International Seaways, we are aligned with a maker of ballast water systems, and, you know, we have some on order, and we will implement that as, you know, the deadlines come at us, right? So it's happening on the ballast water treatment, whereas the sulfur is maybe, you know, a couple of years behind that.
And on the sulfur side is also the refineries have a big problem because they have too much bunker C, so they'll have to invest in new crackers. Or the price will come down substantially. So there are a couple right. converging numbers that it doesn't. As someone said it doesn't make any sense for any of us to be the first mover until we get closer to a date, and we can put that decision off by just buying you know lighter fuel.
In some ways, you know, the shipping industry has been a natural burner of some of the heavier fuels that didn't make sense for the refineries to invest their own investment to crack out. And, you know, that's going to go away, right?
So yeah, but bunker is 8% of the fuel in the world, and we consume half of it in our industry.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I think we've
those
hit
are the
our,
only numbers I know.
We've hit our limit. We covered supply. We covered demand. We covered the order book, North Korea, immigration, the cabinet. We got it all done, gentlemen and lady. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.